Hello and welcome to another episode of the Sales RX podcast. My name is Chet Lovgren, aka the Sales Doctor, here as always with my co-host Billy Stein, coming at you live from the Inglewood Studios in Southern California. Today we're talking about a really awesome topic that was actually submitted to us. So the last two episodes of this season, we're actually doing fan submission topics, which is pretty cool. So we appreciate people listening to the podcast and engaging with the podcast. And the topic is going to be around how to develop chemistry with your solutions engineers on product demos. So this episode is really for account executives who are currently demoing product with solutions engineers, SDRs and BDRs who might want to move into an AE role where they're going to have to demo with SEs, and also frontline managers, VPs of sales who are responsible for helping shape the demo process, both from a technical perspective and a sales perspective. Billy, you want to dive a little bit deeper in on who recommended this episode topic and a little bit of your thoughts ahead of time? And then we'll get to finally roasting you about your flannel, which is the best disc.
I knew it was coming.
I'm just going to throw that out.
So it's a rainy day in Southern California.
Very rainy.
Literally none of us know how to act. Mm-hmm. And like, I want to bust a stereotype, by the way, here. Like, you know, everybody in LA panics when it starts raining, and everybody else who loves to rag on people in LA anyway are like, yeah, they can't handle it, their babies. Nobody anywhere can drive in the rain.
Yeah.
I just want to call that out. But personally, I don't actually own a rain jacket. In fact, I only own one jacket, and it's like a Patagonia puffer, which doesn't really fit because it's hot in here.
And you're like, I'm not wearing that to the podcast.
Yeah, I'll I'm not wearing that. So I figured I wanted to hear what your jokes are. See what you got for me.
You know what? Unlike you, I'm a very compassionate person, so I don't have that very mean side of making fun of people.
I think you got a mustache, now you're just turning a new leaf, like new year, new you.
I'm wearing the same outfit from last week, but I'm glad that I have my hair cut because people would probably think we filmed all these in one day when we didn't. We actually filmed
this. I think everyone's going to look at you and just go to their forecast and start updating with that look you got.
Probably. And the lady really butchered my hair. It's way too high and tight. I got to find a good barber. My old barber that I saw for like 4 years retired, and nobody has been able to cut my hair since. It's actually funny. The reference photo I use on my phone when I go and get my hair cut, like randomly at a new place or if I'm traveling or something like that, is from my best friend's wedding like many years ago. And it's funny because nobody that I've ever shown that haircut to has ever been able to replicate it. And you know how LA is. Even if you go to like Supercuts, it's like $38 for a haircut, right? Even my old school barber, it was like, you know, $35. That haircut that I have that I've been trying to emulate ever since cost me $12 in Omaha, Nebraska, like 7 years
ago. It was like $25 in Atlanta, Georgia,
yeah,
with the hot towel treatment.
But even like when I told the lady that was cutting my hair there back then, it was like, you know, I got to tell you this, like I gave her a really nice tip. And she's like, that is like really sweet of you. And I was like, no, you don't understand. I live in LA, and even with a normal haircut and a bad tip, that's how much this would
cost you.
So you gave me a $12 haircut for like $50. So I'm going to give you that extra tip on top of what I would have done. My total cost of this haircut was expected to be around $70. So I'm going to make it so. So
well, I got a great barber in Culver City.
I'm going to have to probably go
cuts there. Hair for $40.
Yeah.
So probably, how's that?
Probably have to go there as long as it's not at a Floyd's. Nothing against
it's not Floyd's. A Floyd's. Just, no. It's they're independent.
Floyd's is Floyd. The first time I went to a Floyd's, I liked it. The second time I went to a Floyd's, I was like, I felt like a number. The third time I went to Floyd's, I was like, oh, this is like the fast food version of a local barbershop. So nothing really against Floyd's. It's just like maybe make me feel a little less transactional because a haircut is a very intimate thing to me. Like it sounds weird, but it's, you know, you're either like one of those people that sit there and the person talks to you nonstop and you're kind of like, could you just cut my hair? Or you appreciate the conversation, or you like a healthy balance where the person waits about 3 minutes into the haircut before they start trying to talk your ear off and gauge, hey, does this person like to chat or not? And they adjust accordingly. I think that person is the best at giving haircuts.
I love going to the barber shop. It's more than just a haircut. When I go, I like to sit. I like to talk. My barber shop, they always have WWE Network on. So there's a lot of nostalgia for me. I'm 35 and still like wrestling.
Awesome. So let's jump into our first segment of the day, cap or no cap. But before we do, a quick word from our sponsors over at Kixi.
If you've been in sales for a while, you've probably noticed that it's harder than ever to get prospects to answer the phone. It's easier than ever to screen calls, and more numbers are showing up as spam likely on people's cell phones.
And apart from the time spent stuck on the phone waiting for prospects to answer, salespeople have to spend a ton of time entering call notes in the CRM, leave voicemails, and create follow-up tasks in the hopes of having future sales conversations. That's why we use Kixi.
It's the modern voice and texting platform that turns your CRM into a true sales engagement platform, all while increasing your answer rates through cutting-edge technology.
With their holistic approach and seamless integrations, you can enable your reps to spend less time on busy work and more time on having conversations with prospects using Kixi's AI-powered features like multi-line power dialing with voicemail detection, advanced local presence, phone number reputation management, and conversation intelligence.
Not only that, Kixi's team of sales engineers will help you build out advanced workflows and automations at no extra cost.
So head over to kixi.com/salesdoc. That's kixi.com/salesdoc. Or click the link in the description. Get a fully loaded 10-day extended free trial for your entire team. You don't even need to put down a credit card, and the trial comes with hours of call credits included.
All right. So our first segment, Cap or No Cap, is where Billy and I take a look at something that's going on in the industry or something we see posted on social media, short form media, maybe on TikTok, and we kind of give it a rating and our thoughts, cap or no cap. Cap, hey, is it total BS, irrelevant, you know, or no cap, like, hey, do we believe in this? Do we think it's virtue, et cetera, et cetera? You get the idea. Typically, we take a piece of content that's relative to the episode title. So I feel like today we would have, if we were holding with the same theme, would have found something having to deal with AEs on demos. I think the best piece of content I've ever seen about AEs working with SEs on demos is the pinned video on my TikTok. If you haven't seen it, you should see it.
It's TikTok. I think you.
That's why
I think you and I have talked TikTok. About this before. I'm quite out of the loop on most social media.
It was, it was when Drake and 21 Savage did the song, "Do Something For Me, 21. And it was like, everybody's making fun of Drake because it's not like he was like trying to seduce 21. So I did the same thing, but it was like AEs to SEs on demos. And then the prospect's just in the middle, like, what's going on? Because the AE's like, SE, do it for me, baby. And the SE's like, okay, yeah, like I'll show them everything. And then the customer's like in the middle. It got like 75K plus views, tons of impressions. It was my favorite one. But we can't. You know, it's not scalable. It's tough because there's like, we had a couple episodes where there was like no content around the topic we were talking about because everybody talks about the same thing, cold calling, leadership, this, that. Like, there's nothing about what does a good onboarding plan look like after the, or what does a good enablement plan look like after their first 30 days? You know, what is handoff, great handoff from AE to CS? We did find one good clip, but that was after we scoured for like 2 weeks.
Right. And part of it is when we're trying to do this, the point is not for us to, you know, find a million pieces of content. The point is that we're supposed to have a conversation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one great representation of like AEs and SEs that I think of is if you watch the Corporate Bro pilot that came out like 4 years ago at the beginning of the pandemic when he was trying to make a TV show, like
not
a longer
the one
form.
From the one he just did, the one
not
way
the not the YouTube series he yeah, did. They had that. Actually done like a real television pilot that got canceled because of the very, very beginning of the COVID pandemic. Mm-hmm. But Raj, the SE for the company, he is hilarious. He's kind of a vampire in that show. And unfortunately, I just don't think the language that he uses would be generally acceptable among our audience. Yeah. So it'd be really hard to cut
hard to put
15 relevant yeah. seconds of him, but yeah. We'll get there. But no, actually, this week, you and I have been talking about this, and I know me and my team and, you know, several of my friends that work in tech, we've all had IPO mania. So, you know, there was the big Reddit announcement this week. And that's kind of what spurned this because last year we had the Klaviyo IPO that was kind of it. And if you've worked in this industry for long enough, like, you know, like this is that's like the journey, right? First you start out as a rocket ship and you build up, then you go public, everybody makes their money. And then you decide if you want to stay there or if you want to go on and try to run it back and do it again. Mm-hmm. So this week, we actually, since you and I were talking about it so much, we're going to talk about one of the articles that you and I had a long conversation about and talk about the state of IPOs that are coming, what it might mean for those employees and some of the companies that are actually hot on the IPO market right now.
Well, and also important in the world of AE and SE, because if you're on product demos, you might work at a company that's later growth stage, right? More technical product. Right. You may be someone who has all the various little things above base salary and variable that you're intrigued to work for a company for. So this might be relative to you, because a big part of like IPO mania that's going to happen this year, and we'll talk about why that's happening. I have some theories behind that, but I think it is relevant a little bit to the audience, but it's also a thing that Billy and I have just noticed. Like, yeah, the whole point is conversation. And, you know, one of the biggest pieces of feedback we get on the podcast is people like it when we kind of talk about the more businessy stuff, mm-hmm. not just like sales or marketing. They kind of like when we break that ice a little bit and talk about the things in our industry, B2B, that affect us. This article is really, it's something else. It talks about how IPOs in 2024 could bring over $100 billion to the stock markets, but which ones will win the race? We want to be comfortable with the companies we talk about and our opinions behind them, but we will talk about, we'll name drop the couple of the five most anticipated IPOs. Looks like Stripe, Databricks, Ola Electric, Klarna, and Reddit. Obviously, I know Klarna and Reddit are D2C companies for the most part. So when I say B2B, I get it, right? You might be a little nitpicky there with my terminology, but those I think are really interesting. And I think this whole thing is really interesting in general because, I don't know, I have my thoughts on like what I think it means when a company wants to IPO, especially like mostly if they're not profitable. Like, I don't know if Reddit's profitable.
Reddit is not profitable, but yeah. You know, Reddit has captured the headlines this week because, you know, middle of the week, even into yesterday, everybody's headlines were about the Reddit S1. An S1, if you're not familiar, is the very technical financial document that a company files to notify the markets that they intend to go public.
Isn't that the one that WeWork, Adam Neumann, tried to file? And then that's when they found out all the dirty laundry about him paying himself from WeWork to other subsidiary companies.
That was part of it. I mean, Adam Neumann's whole thing S1 was not a technical financial document. He kind of skipped the prerequisite material of the S1, yeah, which was what made it so comical.
That was the funny thing about it. It was like, not only did we find dirt, but you also didn't even go that in depth on it. It was right. Like, this is not a real
document. The SEC could not take it seriously, but yeah. You know, Reddit is probably for everybody the biggest name. I think what's Reddit's nickname? The homepage of the internet. But here's a little bit. I mean, you had said Reddit's D2C, but their business model does rely on B2B because like any other social media company, they sell targeted ads and that's where their revenue comes from as a company.
Oh, and probably a bunch of data.
Yes, but we're not going to go too deep on this because I'm not an expert on it. I don't know if you are, but they had their thing last year with the API calls changing that. Basically, for all the other companies where they could API call into Reddit and pull their data so that you could use Reddit information mm-hmm. in a third-party app. I think that killed that. I don't really know.
But they have internal data they probably leverage to government resources.
I'm sure they do. But here's the interesting part about Reddit, because the funny thing about IPO mania in 2024, and I'm sure it's not the last time you and I will talk about it on the show, and it's definitely going to be a subject of continual conversations between me and you this year and probably a lot of people in our industry. Compare Reddit to Twitter for a second. So some of the numbers on Reddit, they're seeking a $15 billion valuation, which is what I heard. For Reddit, 50 million daily active users. And what makes Reddit so curious is Reddit's a 20-year-old company. They weren't started 4 years ago and fast-tracked to a public market. Reddit has 50 million daily active users. That's fewer than Twitter or X or whatever it's called now, whatever its publicly listed name DBA is at this point.
We still call them tweets.
I still call it Twitter.
Why don't they call them exchanges?
I mean, Elon Musk might strike my car with lightning while we talk about this, but like The reality of Reddit is this is a little bit more of a quote traditional tech IPO because they're not a profitable company. Their balance sheet shows them in the red. They don't have as many daily active users as their competition, but it's a sweetheart company, which is why it grabs so many headlines. Because if you think about Reddit, like market manipulation in general happens on Reddit, and everybody talks about Wall Street Bets. You were talking about Dumb Money last week on the pod.
It's now on Netflix. So if you don't want to pay to, that happens every time I rent.
I know what I'm going to,
every time I rent a movie, a week later, it comes out.
I know what I'm going to be doing on a rainy day.
It's a great movie.
Now, but point being, like, Reddit's an interesting IPO because when you think about investing in a stock, you want to see a healthy PE ratio. You want to see EBITDA showing as profitability. You want to take a bet on a company on a public market that's going to do well over time and grow your money. But they might be a meme stock. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so interesting about Reddit making this list, because when you take a look, Stripe's been the number one company in the Cloud 100 for how many years in a row? And they're processing transactions on there. So they've got good, healthy revenue. Databricks, I believe, is now number two behind OpenAI on the Cloud 100. And they've got a great AI play, and everybody that's using something like Databricks is using Databricks specifically.
This is why I'm so excited for the future of the podcast, because I'm looking at our timer and we're at around 15 minutes. And I have so many thoughts and things and collective answers here, but I'm like, we have two other segments to get to. So I will try to be quick, but you know what I mean with like the future of the podcast. This is why I'm excited, because this kind of stuff is amazing and it's fun to talk about. And I think it's really interesting. Two things really quick. I'm going to say this, and I don't want anybody to get mad or anything like that, but I do it because I think you, as a podcaster, you need to see how other podcasters' formats work, the content they're talking about. So by nature, I do watch the Joe Rogan Experience. Okay. Nobody get mad at me, right? Doesn't mean I'm out here like eating elk meat and, you know, prepping for the end of the world, so to speak. But they had, I'm going to butcher it, but they had somebody on their podcast talking about misinformation and how, like, if you read through YouTube comments or even Reddit threads, sometimes like it's so robotic that people did investigation. They found that I think like 28% of user interaction on a platform like Reddit is actually fake. It's either
bots and things like that, or
sometimes companies pumping information or public opinions and views, because then they of course got political with it. But I'm messing up the number. I'm messing up some of the things, but if you independently look at it, there are a ton of fake comments and users on things like Reddit, which is interesting to help steer public opinion and other things like that, which is interesting to me because when Musk bought Twitter, that was one of the things where he was like, the valuation got lower when he found out how many fake users there were. So when you think of a Kim Kardashian with a billion followers on Instagram or whatever the crazy number is, or Kylie Jenner, I can't remember which one it is, billions of followers. How many of those are bots to make their follower count look better? You know what I mean? We talk about LinkedIn, you know, a year ago, a bunch of like LinkedIn influencers were complaining about how they lost 3,000-5,000 followers because LinkedIn did a scrub of old inactive accounts. Well, you know what accounts are old and inactive? Bot followers that you bought on a social media page. So what if the trick was, ooh, I'm going to start getting big on LinkedIn. I'm at 2,000 followers. Let me go buy myself 5,000 followers real quick so I can get closer to 10. Then I hit the 10 milestone really quick. I'm only at like 11 and change myself. And I'm not even like, my growth is so slow. Like even on TikTok, I'm at like 1,500 followers, but it's because it's slow, because I'm not trying. Like I see some people on TikTok, I'm like, how did you get 20,000 followers, but you have like 300 views per video? It doesn't make sense to me, because it's the whole bot thing. And so when I look at something like that, when you think about like active users or even like all the metrics, what I'm really boiling down to is it's so weird that in tech and with tech IPOs, we've gotten so far away from the thing that's most important. What's the thing that's most important for a company?
Good financial fundamentals and profitability.
Money. Are you making money? And I think that a lot of investors, and I say that because I will say this, you can give me your insight because I know you're a lot more educated on some of this stuff than I am. And then we can, I give final thoughts and move to the next piece because I want to make sure we get through everything. But I firmly believe that these are just five of the big ones. There's all this talk about how tons of companies are going to try to IPO this year. There's an IPO craze. And I firmly believe that investor patience has run out. They believe the old model of be unprofitable until we have nine lines of business like Uber and we finally turn a profit and make it out is dead. I don't think that's what they want to do anymore. I think companies are sick of paying co-founders and founders with egos who want to be the boss of their own company, investing and dumping tons of money into something that is just hemorrhaging money for 5-10 years at a time. I think that model's dead. I think you're going to see a lot more bootstrap companies that get to profitability themselves before taking on investor in dollars to become larger than life. Because I think that investors are really getting sick and tired and have seen the amount of money that they've lost, and the model is kind of dying. The same way that, unfortunately, a lot of companies are seeing that the SDR model is dying. The Aaron Ross predictable revenue model is dying. We're moving more towards full cycle or even PLG and only letting the enterprise side of our business be facilitated by sellers. So I firmly believe that the look at all these metrics, daily active users, monthly active users, engagement time on pages, all this stuff, I believe that's going to start going out the window and investors are really going to be going back to basics. Well, what am I making off this? What's the, where's the money coming in? Because at the end of the day, we don't get paid because we have 50,000 daily active users. We get paid because we spent $10 million to run the company. We brought in $30
million. And so importantly for this, because the stock market doesn't really care about the growth of a LinkedIn influencer, unfortunately. So are you saying you think that Reddit's overvalued at a $15 billion valuation?
I'm saying that every company typically gets overvalued because we look at all these things like daily active users, monthly active users to determine their valuation when it's like, what does that matter? Because so much can be faked. Like, well, that's exactly what happened with Twitter. Their valuation went down because Musk scrubbed it and they found all these bots. We see it happen even in the simplest form. That's why I bring up the LinkedIn thing where all these people lost 3,000 to 5,000 followers. And they're like, why did that happen? Well, those are the 3 to 5 you bought to get your LinkedIn profile boosted and started. It's so easy to do. It's easy for an individual to do it all the way up to, it would be nuts to think that massive companies with revenue don't do things to trick their numbers. That was a whole bit in Silicon Valley. Remember? Spoilers, by the way. So press.
Are you talking about the click farm with the
uptick? Click farm? Yeah. I mean, and that's the early stage startup, you know, or seed round startup. Like, so it's hard to think that a company like Reddit isn't finding a way to hit the metrics they need to increase their valuation. But that's why I'm saying, that's why I think investors are going to get to a point where the only thing they really care about in their valuation and their investing dollars is profitability.
Yeah. I think it's really important to call out here. Like, when you file an S1, your next step is you go and you find an underwriter, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, whoever, to get a valuation and to compare your revenue model to what your future growth looks like, which is goes into all that financial modeling that ultimately decides what your IPO valuation is, thus how many shares are going to be available upon opening.
Which was basically built on Enron's accounting method.
No, that's very, no. That's very different.
Will that go there?
These companies are nothing like Enron, for clarity. Enron had faulty accounting principles like that. That's entirely different
companies is wrong too. You don't know. We don't know if Reddit's going to be able to become profitable because in their financials, like you just said, they're not. They're in the red. And so that's why investors.
Right,
that's
right, why we're right. And I think
Chet, they want to cash out. Liquidity event. Get my money. Get out.
But I think the important thing that I'm trying to demarcate here when we think about these, I think Klarna, Databricks, Stripe, Ola Electric, they all have traditional business models. And I think honestly, since my portfolio is so levered up in tech companies, Ola Electric is the most interesting of them all because they make two-wheelers for countries like India, countries like Thailand that have a lot of two-wheel vehicles on the road. They got great growth potential. I think the point on Reddit here is the mention of daily active users. The only reason that people bring that up is because they do look at it compared to Twitter, who's been taking a beating on public markets. And so when people think about, is this a good stock to invest in? The theory would tell you, no, it probably is not. But the interesting thing about Reddit too, is Wall Street Bets might decide one day, hey, let's all go in on Reddit because we like our community here and we feel nostalgic about it the way we feel nostalgic about GameStop. That's what makes Reddit such an intriguing potential IPO. But to your point, you're absolutely right. I mean, there are other companies that are out there that didn't make this list that have cleaner balance sheets, that have bigger plans on how they can diversify their businesses and grow. I don't think the most important thing to the common investor is how many followers does somebody have and how do they go about getting it?
Yeah, but so that's the thing. Let's do two things real quick. Pull up a tab and search Rivian.
You know, my eyes aren't going to be able to see this right now.
search Rivian stock. Because this is what's interesting to me. So if they're not profitable, if we're not sure how they'll be profitable, click, see if you can click year to date. If, or even max, if you can, it's the farthest right grayed out one up there. But there was a bank then that also IPO'd earlier in 2023. Same thing. They IPO'd and it's just tanked. And so to that's the whole interesting thing behind this that I think is a bigger question is, why is Reddit trying to IPO then? If they're not doing well financially, and we've seen what's happened to companies like Twitter and the volatility of a social media stock, like, and that's just one example. We have other companies that I get it, like Stripe, like it kind of just makes sense. Massive payment processing, a lot of features, right. Like yeah. But these are only the only five, right? But there are tons of companies outside of this that can probably get to an IPO. And the whole question is, well, why do they want to IPO? I am a firm believer that what's going on right now is investors are freaking the fuck out. And they want their money. And the only
I do agree that Reddit's a liquidity event.
Non-explicit lyric podcast. I'm seeing stuff like this and I'm like,
but there are a lot of these. I mean, liquidity events are why a lot of companies go public. That's not new and unique to the circumstances. And I agree with you again that I don't think Reddit belongs on the same list as these other companies right now. I think there's truthfully more exciting IPOs that are going to happen this year than Reddit, but Reddit is that loose cannon in that so many people are so romantic about the service that they provide that who knows, it could be a stock that's worth 12 cents but trades for $400 and goes straight up a hockey stick.
So knowing that investors are panicking and there's a huge desire to IPO to cash out, other liquidity events include mergers and acquisitions. By the way, we saw a massive acquisition from HubSpot, massive acquisition. Clary acquired Groove. We've seen some acquisitions happen this year. You know, companies that are mid-market getting brought in by enterprise companies. So as someone who's been in this world, because you've been in situations where you have stock options, you have stock RSUs, as you refer to them, like you have investments in companies that you've worked at, how does this play into the mindset that people should have if they work at a company where that is their world and they realize that in the investing world right now, investors are panicking and they want to get their money as soon as possible. So I could potentially be at a company where we might be acquired pretty soon, or hey, we might end up buying a company and my job responsibilities are going to expand, or hey, we might IPO, or hey, I have financial interest in this company. So all three of these things need to be constantly in my mind. Like, how do you approach your day to day and like, what can you do to prepare for anything that might happen?
Yeah, well, I worked at a company that is, I guess, beyond the five on this list because Reuters leaked that they are in the process of refiling their S1 and finding an underwriter. Right now, if you're at one of these companies and you were granted ISOs or NSOs, which are stock options that allow you to purchase stock within the company at an agreed upon price per unit, and then you make money based on however well it does beyond that point. Very common in the tech world. Right now, if you're at one of these companies and that's what you're doing, buy your stock as soon as you can if you believe it's going to do well, because your tax burden will be less today the way it's modeled, because if they successfully IPO, then your value goes up and then your capital gain on it goes up and then your taxes go up on it. The other thing, if you work at a company that's going public, there's usually a moratorium period post IPO, 6 months, a year, not uncommon, where Chet, the employee who owns 20,000 shares of Databricks, and good for you if that's you, by the way.
Podcast is going new level. Yeah. Maybe.
You cannot sell those shares within 6 months or a year of IPO. That's got to be very interesting.
How does that play for investors? Because I don't know.
I don't know how that plays for investors, because I'm sure their option type is very different than.
So pull up Rivian again, because I think that's interesting to that argument. If you're an investor and you IPO and you have the option to cash out once that IPO happens, good for you. But if you look at like the trajectory,
of six months
from now, what am I going to sell for?
Well, pennies? You got to hope that it's still higher than whatever your strike price was. I think we saw Rivian was what, like $14 per share
right now. I think it was like, yeah, but I think it IPO to like 60.
Okay. But there's something called a strike price, which is if you're an early stage employee, maybe you paid 70 cents per share. And at $14, you're still doing great. You're not doing as well as you did at 60, but
you're not cashing out like the investors.
Right. And investor stock, I don't know what style that comes in as for employees. There's usually four stock types that I'm used to. There's ISO, NSO, which are in short, and I won't get too deep into the technical because I'm sure you're going to time cop me here, but you buy in. And there's a tax burden that's associated at either time of exercise or time of purchase. ISOs, far more employee friendly than NSOs are. Because when you have an NSO, and I'm not a tax expert, and it's important for me to say that because everybody does. Yeah. If you buy an NSO for $2 and the fair market value is $20, you get taxed on the capital gain at the time of exercise. And then again, at the time of sale. So the first time you exercise it, you might incur a tax burden like ordinary income. And then you get taxed again, whereas ISOs, you only get taxed once you sell them. There's also RSUs, restrictive stock units, which I don't pay anything for and the company grants me, but those usually come at a higher price. And then my capital gain is lower when I sell it because I didn't get it for a few pennies like some ISOs are. The last kind is what's called an ESO. This is very common after a company is already public, where every paycheck, similar to a 401k, I can contribute X amount to buying company stock. Mm-hmm. And they'll value it at 10% lower than market rate. So basically,
I had that when I worked with Darden Restaurant Group for like 5 years when I was doing Olive Garden in college. And then when I moved to LA and I was working at Capital Grille as a bar manager, I just had like, I had like $50 a week coming.
And what was your rate on it? Did you get it?
Oh, like 10X. Yeah. Because by the time I ended up selling it, Darden stock was selling for like $78 or something. Sure. I can't recall, but
did you get your ESOs at like 10-20% below whatever trading rate at the time?
Way cheaper.
So yeah, you were getting discounted. I was like, why is the stock
more expensive than what I'm buying it for? When I ended up leaving there and I cashed, it was like 12 grand I had made just putting a little bit of money by every week.
Brilliant.
It was
on 50 bucks a week. That's awesome.
Yeah. I was like, oh, okay, cool. I can go get a new car now, like down payment.
And so in short, like, look, and this probably bodes future conversation where we actually break down these different types of stock options for employees. But to bring this airplane to a landing, I'm going to say this is no cap. Because as an employee of any of these companies, I'd be stoked if we were coming into this position where the market feels good enough about where it's going that they do want to introduce new capital and new ways to make money into the market. I'd be fired up. No cap.
I think I have to take the same stance you do. Like no cap for the employees, if that's who we're thinking about.
I'm always thinking about the employees.
Clearly no cap to the investors. Cap to the market, though, and any retail investors. That's how I look at it, because that's from someone who got really excited when SoFi finally said, hey, you have enough money in your accounts to be considered an IPO investor with us. We're going to notify you of these, and seeing three IPOs happen through them and seeing what happens after people buy that IPO and can't sell it for like a couple weeks and then seeing where the stock goes. I'm like, lot of people are going to go, oh, Reddit, awesome. But to your point, if Wall Street Bets just goes, hey, we love Reddit, let's just, you know, diamond hands to the moon. Sure. Like, yeah, I could.
Chicken tendies.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I mean, I could see it. I could see that being a thing. And if you watch the movie Dumb Money, maybe you'll all jump on the Reddit train, too, when they offer the stock. But love it. All right. Let's jump to the next segment. Billy's Black Book. All right, so this next segment is called Billy's Black Book. This is the part of the show where Billy essentially has professional learning that he's documented over his career that builds off the topic of what we're talking about today. And, you know, he kind of gives us his take on it. We do a little – some questions on my side. It's kind of a interview style, get some additional context from him. And this is going to be about the relationship side of working effectively with solutions engineers. So – Billy, let's let it rock. Let's give us some context to what we're talking about.
All right. So I'm pretty excited about this one. You know, we've been pretty lucky since we started doing this that, you know, when you do a podcast, you start by showing it to your friends and you post it in a few places where people that maybe don't know you will actually listen. But this one's fun because this was user submitted, and the way in which this came up is absolutely iconic. So I was at Derek Hall, who's your compatriot from Hatchet Ventures, and he's VP of sales engineering at ServiceTitan. I was at his house in Burbank back in December, and we started talking about the podcast, and we were chatting through, like, all right, what's coming up? What are you guys talking about? He said, well, when are you going to give SE some love?
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't really thought about it because that was, to me, the second most stimulating thing in the room at that moment, because me and my wife were hanging out with him and his wife, and we were watching Vanderpump Rules, which is a show I don't watch. My wife watches it. The Halls watch it.
Dude, you know why I love you so much? Because you're like the classic husband who watches the wife's shows with her.
Absolutely.
And I love that because I am not that way at all. And guess what? My wife is not that way. She's like, I don't want to watch my shows with you. I want to watch them myself and enjoy them in peace. And then we have our shows we watch together. Like, kind
well, of I have my shows I watch alone too, because she doesn't like scripted TV.
Oh, really?
Like, at all. That's amazing. So there are certain things that I watch on my own, but I don't watch Vanderpump Rules. And so, like, there was drama on their last season. There was some scandal going on. And, you know, reality TV is escapism, right? Yeah. So, like, I'm hearing about all this for the first time. And the whole point of the way they produce these shows is you think, like, better you than me, pal. Mm-hmm. And that was it. So then, like, getting to L back, he said, well, when are you going to talk about sales engineers? Because I listened to the show. You guys talk about everything else. So,
yeah, sales, marketing, CS.
I guess I hadn't really thought about it. I was like, man, this seems like it should be commonsensical, but it's not. And, you know, he and I, like, I'm so stoked to talk about this because Derek basically firsthand had a lot to do with the content and the subject matter, which we're going to discuss, which, you know, I talked to some other SE friends and he's a pretty sharp dude. So look, here's the thing about sales engineers. And let me take that back. Here's the thing about great sales engineers is they are mystical incantations. Mm-hmm. They are like the Minotaur in the Labyrinth or Khaleesi's dragons or hitting a hole in one at Pebble Beach. Like, a great sales engineer really doesn't feel like they're from this planet. Mm-hmm. And I mean that in a good way. And, you know, when it comes down to it, there is, and I was certainly reminded, there's some aporia with what an SE actually does and what's their responsibility. And why does it feel like expectations for SEs are so ludicrous? And I think it bodes conversation. And because we had a pretty Cabernet-driven conversation that night while watching trash TV, we were very prepared to talk about things. And they're going to range from, like, what their responsibilities are, where these things go wrong. Like, in the background, what we don't see as salespeople, what are they actually doing? So I was pumped to get to talk to Derek about it, stoked to talk to you about it.
So I'm sure a lot of people that are listening to this probably know what their SE does, but outside of just showing up to demos, like, what does an SE do? What are they responsible for?
Yeah. So first and foremost, like, when Derek and I talked about this, he said this six different times in the conversation. And then I talked to three other SEs and everybody said the same thing. SE's job is to get the technical win, period. And, you know, we think about that in terms of like, I'm on this call right now with Chet, my sales engineer. His job is to help me win this deal. But no, it's way bigger. And the way they go about it, like even just starting with customer calls, is an SE's job is to build trust and credibility via product capabilities, right? Like we all know that. But this is where the term solution consultant comes from, because an SE doesn't think of themselves as just a salesperson. They are a trusted advisor to that customer. And you think about that. It's like when you talk to an SE as a customer, your guard is down. AEs, we know we're a necessary evil, and we know that we're always going to be guilty until proven innocent, because a stigma was decided about salespeople long ago. Sales is an environment where there are people that have good intentions and there are people that don't have the best intentions, and people come across that.
That's why I don't like having SEs on discovery. Some companies do that. I'm like, no.
No.
Because your deal is made in discovery. That's what the sale's made. And it's like there's a lot of selling that happens with the way we ask questions. They shouldn't be there until the demo. And I know some companies do that, and there might be technical reasons why. But if those are box-checking technical questions, give them to your AE to ask real fast. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, and that's a good point, Chet, because I think it's really important to call out that AE's job is to know the business, right? Like discovery questions, unless you are a very small, predictable, one-size-fits-all product, the role of the AE is to ask questions about the business that you're speaking to.
Yeah.
So that by the time you bring an SE in, you understand roughly what the box looks like for a company. You understand how they operate, and that allows an SE to speak to what the product does, why it does it, and how it helps you, Mr. or Mrs. Customer. And that trust that they build is really predicated upon the fact that they're not going to be the ones ultimately asking for the close.
No.
And instead, their posturing and like what the real responsibility of an SE is to know best what a customer needs and how the company is going to produce those needs for the customer.
So in your orgs and companies, like what are some of the things SEs did in tandem with their AEs?
Yeah.
Obviously demoing, right? Like, yeah, we get it.
Definitely. Like, I mean, that's a given, right? They're the technical counterpart. They're a co-pilot.
There's also the AE who's like, hey, don't try to sell on my deal. You know, we were publishing some TikTok video memes about like, you know, Samuel Jackson, I didn't ask you a goddamn thing from Pulp Fiction. And it's like how AEs talk to SEs when the prospect asks a question that could lose their deal. You know, like there's that whole balance too, right? Like how much do I let the SE participate in the sale part of it?
There is. And I think that comes down to personalities that play with the AEs. But like, let me give you three landscapes or how I've seen SEs operate within the business. In a more enterprise style approach where everything is bespoke all the time and your first demo of the day is very different from your second or your third, if you even run that many demos in a day. But I mean, I've seen custom demo tenants be built. I've seen SEs that are responsible for kind of being the supporting wing during like a trial of a product. I've seen SEs help document things that lead to the statement of work that ultimately gets built out. And that all feels very enterprise. It feels very horizontal. In a more vertical approach where, hey, look, rinse, repeat, just do it again because the concept is the concept and it feels a lot more binary. Some of those SEs are just more, all right, I got six demos today. So path of least resistance, I get done, I hit reset, I go do it again. Mm-hmm. Maybe I help out with some of the technical documentation that associates with ultimately the handoff into implementation. And then I have to bring this up because this is like I know we talked to a lot of startup founders. This is a great example of like what not to do. So I led a small sales team that had five total sellers, one being an SE. And unfortunately, this gentleman was involved in every demo. sometimes when SE or AEs were double booked or sick or generally unavailable, I saw this guy take AE demos, i.e. he was doing discovery calls and he was just the solution when he was on the phone. He was doing onboarding work. He was doing ongoing customer success work. It was just a lot. It wasn't scalable. And you could see the burnout. And also on the other end, you could see the dependency on that one individual, which means don't take vacations, don't get sick, because we need you all the time. And it was a very unhealthy relationship because ultimately his job scope didn't align at all with what his job description or his comp plan was. And it got very messy very quickly.
So what did you do for that SC that had all those responsibilities?
I immediately got him a pay increase. It was like, you know, when you come in any leadership role, you have a 30, 60, 90 that you're expected to play out. And if the buck stops with you, you know, that it's scrutinized a whole lot more. And there was a point probably 2 months into that job, I had to stop some of the other things and I had to pull my co-founders in and say, like, understand the flight risk that comes here if we don't get it right for this SE. So luckily we were able to do that, but unfortunately his pay might have changed, but his job scope didn't, and that was problematic.
So in your eyes, what should an SE's job be and what should it not be?
Yeah, so counterpart, co-pilot to the AE. When you are on a demo, an AE should know the people and an SE should know the product. And we talked about fitting into the box, right? Like, SE's got to make those puzzle pieces fit for that customer. When I think about presentation, so I always think, like, when you do a tee up and when you introduce to the buyer or the buyers who are on the phone as an AE, usually if you have an hour, you need to give that SE 45 to 50 minutes, right? When it's prime time for that SE, they are the play-by-play. And AE, you cannot sit on mute. You cannot space out or check Reddit, since we were talking about Reddit. You got to be the color commentary for them while they do the play-by-play.
Can't play Call of Duty just because you're off camera.
Now, number three, like, another big thing is, like, we talk about getting the technical win. And in my sales process currently, we rely on SEs a lot as strategists in between meetings. And when we bring them in on things and we run through, you know, our summary notes from everything, and when we talk about our next steps, they're right in there and they're hands on talking about, like, okay, workflow. Here are the things that we can do that we can marry to what they're doing. That strategy, it allows for that technical win, because SEs, here's the back office stuff that most salespeople don't know. SEs do a lot of technical documentation. And when I talked to Derek, he said, what you have to understand about an SE is we are the connective tissue between sales and product/engineering. Mm-hmm. So SEs work really, really hard with R&D. And what they're doing is they're relaying information to the product team for what needs to be built, because here's what it can do. It can win more deals against existing customer personas. We can unlock new TAM and expand our overall sales strategy. Product updates that we see on a daily basis, those came from the SEs for the most part. They don't normally come from just the product team that's in the background or the engineering team that are drinking 4 Red Bulls and trying to code out as many lines as they can. The other thing, when I think of SEs, and this is something that I think people have a very imperfect understanding of what the goal of an SE is. When it comes to enablement, SEs should have a very passive role in it, specifically to the product. Specifically, if something new is coming out, or if we're really struggling with how to position a certain feature set, how does it work? Who does it benefit? And how do we speak to it? That should be in partnership with sales enablement or sales leadership, but they should have a passive role, because SEs really know more about every nook and cranny of the product than anybody else at a company does. Mm-hmm. So when I think about SE responsibilities, like, This is SE validated. This is what they believe they do. This is what they should do. And that scope really shouldn't change much.
So we're going to talk a little bit more about tactical execution in the demo in the next segment. But outside of that, relationally, what's the best way for an AE to work with an SE?
Yeah. So SEs, it's very important to understand, like, the number one way SEs feel disenfranchised is they feel like they are at times secretaries to the sales team. They took that job knowing that they're not going to get all the pats on the back. They're not going to get the glory, but they deserve it. A few things I think about. SEs want to be set up for success. If you're interacting with an SE or you need something from an SE, before you even reach out, before you Slack them, before you set a meeting, check their calendar. Usually speaking with SEs, they have buffers built into their calendars after a meeting. They have documentation time. They have cross-departmental meetings that are happening. If you need something one-off, check their calendar first. Give extremely detailed context. There was a funny video I saw on Instagram this week. I think we've played him before, Corporate Sween, one of my favorite like parody accounts. And it was this video about a burnt out SE. And it was like, all right, when's the call? Oh, it's at 3. Oh, I'm triple booked. Who's it with? No, I don't care what their first names are. What do they do? Who are they at the company? What do they want to see? This kind of context, it needs to be in detail, and it also needs to be in writing. When you think about an SE, again, it's a co-pilot. You can't expect that they're going to drive the direction of whatever chess pieces you need to move in order to close the deal. But you can give them direction and leverage their feedback, especially if they're a tenured SE. They've been on more calls than you have. Mm-hmm. So you can trust that they've seen probably more things than you have that have led to positive results in a deal, holistically for the company, whatever. And lastly, and this is the most important thing, show gratitude. So when you're working with an SE, a thank you goes a long way. When you, if your company does like a welcome email for a new logo close, call them out. Mm-hmm. Importantly, SEs just want the reverence they deserve. And if you have a really great team of SEs, like, those are the absolute workhorses in a sales organization that need to, it needs to be known that they worked extremely hard. They should get that credit and that gratitude just as much as the AE, because it's a team effort.
And not even just working hard, they put a pride and emphasis on being smart. And so knowing that they were able to have a technical win goes, absolutely, I know that little intricacy about the product. I love that. All good stuff. All right, let's move on to our next segment.
All right, moving on to our final segment. This is Doctor's Orders. This is the part of the show where you, the listener, submit your questions and go-to-market challenges to get a prescriptive, tactical, and practical approach by the sales doctor himself. Chet, we got an ask from you about what should demo execution look like? And yeah, I feel like this is a great topic because, you know, if you're working, especially in a technical sale and you have a technical sales engineer, I feel like this is a perfect way to tie a bow on this. So how do you think about it?
Yeah, and this one's a crowdsourced opinion from me preemptively reaching out to people and saying, hey, we're talking about AE and SE relationships. What should we talk about?
Oh, right on.
What's something you want to know about? Also, I've gotten some feedback from people that it's pretty disappointing that we're almost done with the third season. And I still haven't got a lab coat for doctor's orders yet. So I think that might have to be something we order.
Have you ever looked at lab coats?
They're expensive.
I was going to say.
It's like, oh, there's a reason. The first thing I want to call out on demo execution, kind of on the heels of what you were talking about, working with AEs and SEs. One thing I advise sales leaders is to find a way to, I know it varies for everyone, but I'm a firm believer that AEs should have an SE they work with pretty regularly. As a person that sold product before, shout out Louis Rochette, 90% of what I sold on demos with Louis. And it's just because the way we worked on demos together, it was just magic. Like, I sold some with another SE, but I knew some people that just Al Norbomani, one guy loved to work with him. Every demo he had, he worked with him. Majority of my demos, I worked with Louis. Al Nor was kind of my backup if Louis wasn't available. Then there was another guy named Ripley. And there were like a couple of people that I loved just working with Ripley because it was styles, you know, and I just felt like it's a very smart thing to think about, like, how can I pair? And I don't believe in SDR to AE pairing, but I do believe in AE to SE pairing.
How did that work? I mean, were you a one-to-one pod? Were they aligned to your team? Was it a round robin and you kind of worked the channels?
Okay. It was a free-for-all, but we all kind of started just slumping into the same people. And then we brought on Garrison. Garrison was pretty cool. I liked working with him then because then Louis moved into sales. So then I ended up working a lot more with Garrison. But yeah, it was we all just started finding who we were comfortable with and we tried to book them. And if they didn't, we went to our second person that we worked well with. So me, I'd always try to book Louis. If Louis wasn't available, I'd go work with Alnor. Then it was Louis, Alnor, Ripley, and Ham. And I would go to Louis, Alnor, Ham. Rip was always kind of my last in line. Just because, you know, we just had very different styles, you know what I mean? And so I felt like I won one deal with Rip, but there were also things that you would think about bringing someone in for. Like if I was doing straight, you know, logistics, so this will bore a little bit of people, but if I was doing straight pallet in, pallet out warehouse workflow, I would be like, dude, Alnor can just demo this, get through. He'll talk about the B2B side of things. If I was doing a warehouse that specialized in e-commerce, of course I wanted Louis on there because the way that we talked about all the benefits a warehouse can get by using our software for small parcel shipping, e-commerce shipping, Louis and I just had our talk track down, you know, in the way that we would demo together. But if he wasn't available, then I'd bring in a backup just in general. But it was sometimes I would go, hey, I'm not going to bother Louis with this because he's so great with the e-com warehouses. I'm just going to go see if Alnor wants to do this one. So there were times where I preemptively chose, but we just naturally gravitated towards people like, you know, Alex liked working with Alnor. Stan liked working with Ripley. Like we just all kind of gravitated. But I think after having witnessed that, I saw the benefits that each person had working with a counterpart. And so I think and like some people work really well with Alnor in addition. So, you know, pair him up with two people, pair this guy up with two people, pair this gal up with two people. If that's, you know, the demo extent, but we got to a point with, what do we have? 8 sellers. We had 4 SEs. They were booked. And they were at capacity. They were on 4 to 5 demos a day minimum. So if you're thinking about doing, you know, pairing, that there's your number. You know, 2 AEs to 1 SE.
Sounds like you had great pipeline over there.
Yeah. Well, who was helping the SDRs and the BDRs at that time when they didn't have a manager? Hell yeah. the power of outbound, baby. So that's one thing I wanted to call out before we dive into the actual execution side of it. I know we're going a little over our expected time, so I'll be quick with this because I think it's more bullet point of what I think people should think about. If you're listening to this podcast, you probably tuned out 15 minutes ago because people kind of tune out after 45 minutes. That's just the nature of it. We don't have these large attention spans. So it really frustrates me that people set hour demo calls, no matter how technical your product is, because even if you're selling a technical product to a technical person, they're tuning out after the first 20 minutes typically, because if you're a very technical person, that means that you're probably really into computer stuff. And if you're really into computer stuff, that means you probably have some form of like hyperactivity, right? Like a lot of screens. We constantly need stimulation. So schedule a 45-minute call because that's different than everybody else also. And only expect to really demo for 20 to 30 minutes at first. And that first demo should be a more problem fit based demo where it's a high level overview. We're not going to get into the super nitty gritty stuff. This is me just showing you the software and applying it to the 2 to 3 core challenges that you said you had. Demo decks, I don't think you need an extensive demo deck. I hate showing up to a demo and seeing like a 7-page deck with like testimonials and all this crap. I do like a welcome thing on the screen, like a welcome deck slide, so that they're at least showing up with something on the screen. And then I like hopping to like not an agenda deck, because I hate when people use the term agenda because then it's selfish. It's like, well, that's your agenda. What about my agenda? And you can't tell me what my agenda is because you're not me. How dare you? So I like the word objectives. Hey, Billy, the objectives on today, you know, when we talked about sales training for your team, the objectives that you outlined was, I want to get my people to not be afraid to hop on the phones. I want to get them thinking about intentional follow-up. And more importantly, I also want them to be able to better handle objections and set expectations for future follow-up so they know if their prospect literally is never going to pick up or if this just isn't a priority for them right now and we have an opportunity a month or two down the road. So not only were we building our conversation pipeline for future pipeline dollars, but we're also potentially handling those first level objections so we can move them into pipeline right now if the priority they state aligns with our value prop. Those are the three things you said were important. Did I miss anything that we needed to talk about today that's of utmost importance? No, that sounds great. Show me how what you do can solve those things first. And those are the two to three things, depending on those problems, that you're going to show for that show in the demo on your product. It are the three things that you uncovered, maybe two if that's only as far as you got, and how your product helps. I think you open up the demo after that with a 60-second UI overview. I've heard conflicting things about this, but I think it's comfortable to say, hey, this is where you're going to live every single day. You know, you have these modules here, and these are your admin modules here. As you can see, there's the main interface here, and then we separate this out by tabs over here. However it lays out, just give them a general idea of how you're going to be navigating the tool and the UI, and you can do that in 60 seconds. This is a big tactical thing I always tell people they should be doing because it's very important and it goes a long way. Somewhere in the demo, you're going to hand the keys over to them after demoing a certain function and let them do it. Now, when I say that, people go, oh, but what if they don't do well and then they mess up and they're like, the software's too hard to use. That can happen, but that can happen because people don't usually do it right. I'll give you a great example. When I used to demo with Louis at 3PL Central, the most routine thing was how to collect against an advanced shipping notice. It was literally like a 60-second task. So what we would do is after he would demo it, we would share controls and we would let them work through the screen and process one on their own. And they typically do it in about 2 minutes. That's great, even though it took them a little bit of time and he had to say, no, you want to click there because this will keep that. It's great because it helped them envision their own usage. They kind of like created some ownership, like, oh, I'm already using the tool. That's cool. Why do you think companies do those free trials? Because they want people using the tool. It also gauges their attention and interest. If they don't have any idea how to even press the very first button in the step you showed them, they're not paying attention and they're not interested in the demo. They're already working on Slack on the side or they're looking at their phone or whatever. So it's a great way to gauge where someone's at, attention and interest wise. It also demonstrates the ease of use. Hey, Billy, I just showed you how to do this thing in 60 seconds and you were able to do it after just watching me for 60 seconds in 2 minutes. Imagine how fast your team's going to be able to do that after one training session and having done this repetitively for 2 weeks, because this is a normal routine thing they're going to do in the software. That also helps quantify that speed to value and qualify the speed to value. Hey, when you manually process an advanced shipping notice, it takes your team 10 to 12 minutes a day. We just did it in 60 seconds. After one 60-second training, it took you 2 minutes to do it. Imagine how fast your team's going to do it after doing it normally for a month. You process 10 advanced shipping notices a day. I just cut an hour every day off your team's time easily. Like that, so that not only quantifies, but it also qualifies that there's value, but it also quantifies it. So give them the keys for a routine task after demoing it. And then when you close the call, two things that I really like to have conversations about, even after the high level demo, we might need a technical demo later on, an hour demo with people that need to scope it technically, whatever, that's fine. Even after this high level demo, there's two things I like to do. Number one, Billy, what did you see most today that you liked and why? Because I want to know the good things, not the bad things. Because you're going to tell me the bad things potentially with my next question. That sounds great. I agree. Yeah, we can really do this. This is how it's going to help you. The second question I ask is, Billy, have you seen enough to make it make sense to have a conversation about the numbers? Because now I'm sure, and especially if you don't publish your pricing, like most companies, even if you publish your pricing, but it might change because of seats or feature sets or whatever that might be in version of the software that you're offering, level of package or whatever you want to call it. It's important to let them walk away understanding what the cost is, because you don't want them, and not, you know, you're not giving them a final price out the door. You're giving them a recommendation because you want them to understand that level if you have to do another call. Because about timing, you know, you want to make sure that we're on the same page with expectations. When I tell people that, and they say, yeah, it makes sense. Let's talk about it. Like, I think my boss is going to love this, or like, hey, it solves this problem for us. Sometimes people will go, you know what? I really got to see how those APIs are going to work with our different shopping carts. Is there like a test room we can do where we can hook up a customer shopping cart? Let's handle that objection. Cause yeah, it's worrisome. If I have customers I'm fulfilling orders for, how do I know that the Shopify cart is automatically going to notify me that this order just came in? That's a qualm that people would have in the 3PL world, because it's just like, oh, we just connect it and it just works. You know what I mean? Like with the API keys, how do we know it's working? Well, obviously, you know, there's a conversation we had about their implementation, working with an implementation specialist and us testing against it and getting them. So obviously we make sure that it works, but them just seeing it happen on screen, it's like a thing and it's a blocker in their mind. So it's an objection we can get from having that conversation. The reason I like this so much is if they are ready to talk numbers, I go for a contract close. I've never been a person to send a proposal. I think it's stupid. It's like, what else do you need to see? If I'm telling you right now what you're probably going to pay, what more do you need to see? Plus or minus $100 a month. I always say, okay, great. Yeah, let's do it. Grab a pen and paper real quick for me, because then you give them the numbers. If you don't do that ahead of time, I've done things where I go into talking about pricing and it bit me in the butt, because then they're like, well, can you send me a proposal? Oh, well, you know, I give my proposal rebuttal. They say, well, I just didn't have anything. I didn't write down any of the information. And then it's kind of weird to go, oh, well, grab something I can tell you again. So I always preface that ahead of time when they're, yeah, I'm ready to talk numbers. Perfect. Billy, do me a favor. You got a pen and paper real quick? Jot this down. And then we talk about the terms and conditions. We're just about out of time, but I'll share this little golden nugget with you if you actually made it this far into the episode, because this is one of the big secret sauces that I give when I do team trainings. So people pay me good money for this, and this is one of my favorite things to do in closing. I never send proposals. I go for a contract close. Once I give them the numbers, if they say, oh, that's great, can you send me a proposal so I can share it with my boss? Or they want to see the numbers on paper. I always tell them, yeah, I can get something in your hands. Unfortunately, I don't have like a templated proposal that I send. We only send contracts. Now, I can send a contract, and the reason I think it would be important to send that is because in the contract is all the additional language around the terms and conditions of this relationship. The stuff that's more important than price. I hit on that all the time, because that way the price is out of their mind. It's like, you shouldn't even be concerned about what it's going to cost. You should be concerned about, if it doesn't work, how can I get out? If I don't want to get out, what do I have to do to renew? What's the statement of work around support and implementation, all those things. And I say that, I say it's all about the things like, hey, if that doesn't work out, when can I get my money back? If it does work out, how do I renew? What is my renewal price? You know, it's the terms of the marriage, which is more important, right? Because we don't want you around for a year, 2 years. We want you around forever. So we want to make this work. So that contract is going to have all that additional language. Plus, if you look at it with your boss, Billy, and your boss says, Chet, this looks great. I'm ready to go. You can just sign it right there and then, and you're ready to go. You don't need to call me back, try to get a hold of me. I might be out of the office, or I might be on some customer calls and then wait for me to actually generate something from legal and send it over. The power is in your hands. And also, it's a unilateral agreement. So it's not you. You're not promising anything by saying, you know, you'll take a contract today and take a look at it. It's me purely saying, this is what I can offer you today. Here's the investment costs, the terms, the conditions, everything your boss is going to need to look at with you in order to make a decision. Does that sound fair? Then they always, 9 times out of 10, I think one time I had a person balk when I really think about it, but most of the time I go, yeah, just, that's great. Send it over. And typically in the past I would follow up with, now, just so that you know, my contracts do have a 72-hour expiration period with what I'm offering right now. So keep in mind that if I do share this with you, it would be important for you to get with your boss within the next 48 hours to try to talk this over and think about all the things that could lead us to a no, so that we can get those resolved. And if there's any language that you want changed, or any changes to the package, or what we're offering in terms of the pricing and the investment costs, let me know. I can adjust that, and that way I have enough time to get you out another agreement for you two to sign. Sound good? Yeah, sounds great. I can tell you that the second I went from sending proposals or one sheet estimates or quotes to just sending a contract, my close rates went from like being an average 22% seller to closing 38% of the time. Which doesn't sound like a lot, but when you think about like baseball and a batting average, if you're hitting 380, you're doing pretty damn good.
Well, it's 16 more deals out of 100. That's a lot.
Yeah. Thanks for doing the math. I don't have that aptitude. Billy can measure the difference in the percentages and get those for me quickly. That's why he's a human calculator. I leave him up to it. But that's the secret little spicy talk track. I also think I just don't think you're doing anybody any favors by putting another roadblock in your process. And maybe you like that as a sales leader. You're like, I love sending proposals. Bleck. whatever you're sending in a proposal can be sent in a marketing deck after discovery. Here's about us. Here's the value of our product. Here's what people say about us. Yada, yada, yada. The proposals I get maybe in like a, yeah, it doesn't work for everybody because there are some companies where it's like, if you're, especially if you're doing like an RFP, you know, or an RFI, like you literally have to send something, sell to SLED, whatever that might be. I know people that sell to SLED that go for contract closes and do very well because our proposal, Billy, is in the contract. The contract is the proposal, right? And so overcoming that, instead of sending them some 7-8 page PowerPoint deck or something, you know, you're going to see, you can't get the money if you don't get the signature. You can't get the signature if they don't have a contract. Why would you want to wait?
Can I ask you some questions about your structure here?
Yeah.
So because we've been talking about SEs, I just want to clarify the high level overview you talked about. SE's doing that click path, right? That's the handshake between you, or are you running this solo?
That's that first demo with an SE. Okay. Yeah, we're going to do that overview. Here's the three challenges that we're solving for. When you start that demo, you do the UI overview real quick, and then you jump into those, like a routine of it real quickly in like 5 minutes, but you dive really deep into the product features
that user experience overview. Yeah. Okay. And when you were doing this, so you talked about 45 minutes instead of an hour as a way to stand out. How many demos for the structure that you have here? How many demos or technical walkthroughs were usually involved? Is this light touch, quick sales cycle, or is this 4, 5, 6 of these that are all 45 minutes?
Yeah. If you're selling like custom Salesforce stuff, you know, that's a great example. This is going to work for probably 80% of our listeners. For those of you that are in an enterprise role where you just know that it's 2 or 3 demos, this can still work to some effect. I don't ever think any company, no matter what you're selling, should spend an hour, hour and a half on that first demo. You can schedule an hour so you spend 15 minutes with your SE, but the demo should be 45 minutes long, 30 minutes of actual demoing, 15 minutes of conversation. A little bit at the front, a little Q&A at the back. Of course, you're probably going to set another hour-long technical demo to sit in with their team. That's expected. Even in like when we were selling logistics software, that would happen quite a bit. There were a lot of people that we could close after that first demo. It was 30 minutes long. There are a lot of people we couldn't, and they needed to bring in their IT manager or their chief security officer, depending on the size of the warehouse company, you know, the logistics company that we're talking to. And that's okay. But for 80% of people out there that are doing demos and then sending proposals, which is probably 90% of the software I've evaluated purchasing in the last 3 years as a leader in a, well, now we're 3.5 years as a leader in a fractional, this will work because you very rarely move on to that next demo. But you should still, like, in the beginning, no matter what you're doing, that demo should still be 45 minutes, 30 minutes of demo, high level overview, applying product to the core challenges. Then if you want to do a technical demo afterwards, you can. You always have that option, but every company should follow the first 2 steps at least.
Yeah, I think for this, if you're selling to one person on a call and you want to keep them engaged, I think there's a lot of really cool things to hold attention in here. And I think that's certainly something that would be fairly easy to implement if you know on Zoom how to turn your mouse over to somebody else to show them how to click through. I think that could be a great strategy with it. One of the things that you mentioned that's interesting is sending it in contract form, and that definitely does optimize sales cycle speed. When you were doing this, or even your most recent gig as a fractional CEO or CRO or in your solopreneurship, when you send out contracts, do they have to go through legal and security and have pretty robust InfoSec reviews? I'm just curious how that compared to what some more traditional, you know, proposal and technical documents, security bundles, how that might differ for somebody that does sell something that might have a security component to it or touch on a lot of legal IP.
I'd say it's a mix.
Yeah.
I don't think the seller's company needed to go through a bunch of stuff. I think it was more on the buyer side. We've had experiences where, hey, I have a vendor approval process that I need to go through first that follows like not only like technical stuff, but brand stuff as well.
Right.
Because God forbid if your CEO is someone who's going to throw a crazy political statement on X someday and we don't want to be in business with them, right? Like something like that. But that's the power of discovery and why we do that before a demo, because when you follow Medic, you understand their decision process. So, hey, if I was working with Seismic as a sales trainer, I'm sure there is a vendor approval process regardless that I would have to go through first. I'm sure that there's probably at least one other step outside of your control as a decision maker that I would have to go through, maybe with like privacy. Like, I'm sure if I went to go do an internal SKO workshop at Seismic, they would be like, we don't want people knowing that we hired someone outside to come in and help our sales team. I'm not saying they need to. Seismic, I'm not saying I know anything internally. I'm just using that as an example because I have a guy from Seismic sitting in front of me, right? But there's probably a vendor approval. There's probably an NDA thing I have to go through. Well, I could probably knock the NDA out before we even go through my presentation, my version of a demo, right? I could probably
knock that out. NDAs come out early in processes.
And also, if you're a seller, how much deal inertia have you built if you make them go through the thing they usually do after demo? After discovery. Great, Billy. So it sounds like in order to do this, we need to sign an MDNA and I need to go through the vendor approval process for you to be able to purchase this. Even if you love everything, the tool doesn't work. So that we make sure that we're both intentional about this. Let me get those things done before we decide to hop on a demo. Now you're not just going to be able to sit on your ass and fill your time by looking at software with me. No, sirree, I'm not going to be that guy for you. I want to know that you're as bought into this as I am. And I want to know that your boss is as bought into this as I am. So let's go through those other things ahead of time. Because guess what? Newsflash, very rarely do you have to actually see the demo. There's nothing that's done in a demo that typically affects a vendor approval form, right? Because what happens when you get a vendor approval form or there's IT security things? What do you do as the AE? You pass that off to someone. Oh, they want to know about SOC 2 verification, single sign, all the things that you were talking about.
Right.
That demo's not going to affect that. Because if I don't have something on that security checklist, no matter what you see in a demo, that's not going to change it. So how much more powerful is it to make a pit stop and delay your deal by doing that stuff first before you do the demo? Because if somebody's opposed to that, in my mind, it means that maybe you're not really serious about buying the software. So you don't want to do the hard things before you see the software, which I can totally respect. But hey, even if I show you the demo and you feel like it could put you in a rocket ship, send you to the moon and bring you moon rocks and back, it's not going to matter if I don't match up on your vendor checklist. So let's get the vendor approval process done. Let's get my company through the MDNA or whatever we need to sign confidentiality wise before we actually take a look at the software. Because Billy, all of our softwares are bespoke. We don't just run you through the mill. We actually tailor fit our demos. And I would hate to do all that legwork. I would hate for us to do all that legwork if we can't even get approved as a vendor. Oh, look at that. You know what I'm saying? So there's been a healthy mix. But there's a lot of ways that you can solve for that. So you're even like, you know, moving, fitting people in your process to sell as much as possible, if that answers your question.
It does. Yeah.
That's all we have for today. If you're interested in engaging with us in the podcast further, you can head over to the website, www.thesalesdocrx.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the SalesRx newsletter. Check us out on LinkedIn. Check out our sponsor, Kixi, on LinkedIn as well. You can type in www.kixi, that's KIXIE.com. Click CLICK/thesalesdoc to get a 10-day free trial with hours of call credits included. If you're using a tool like Aurum, Nux, Monster Connect, where you're loading up numbers into a power dialer and connecting with prospects who pick up the phone, you should try out Kixi because they do all that and more, especially on the inbound side. They have some pretty cool functionality that these other tools don't tend to have. Plus, from my understanding, what I've seen talking to people in the industry, they're quite a bit more affordable. Their program has a little bit more flexibility. It ultimately almost turns your entire tech stack into a full sales engagement platform. They have integrations with CRMs. It's actually pretty nuts. So in case you're wondering what Kixi does and why they work, that's what they do. And I would encourage you to check out the link to get a free trial. See how you like it with your team. See how you like it for yourself. Maybe you want to show it to your SDR manager, your AE manager. It'd be awesome. If you're listening to the podcast on Spotify, give us a 5-star rating. Don't forget to click follow so that we publish to your feed organically every week when we publish new episodes. If you're listening to us on podcasts with Apple, make sure you review the podcast. Type in some nice words about us. Give us a 5-star review or a 1-star review if you think the show sucked. That's all for us. We look forward to seeing you here every Wednesday at 7 a.m. Pacific, 10 a.m. Eastern on another episode of the SalesRx podcast. Peace out.